Now, continuing the same chapter, that is Greek criticism, Aristotle. The next subheading before us is definition of tragedy, its nature, theory, and conception sources of tragic pleasure, epic and tragedy. The poetics is concerned chiefly with tragedy, which is regarded as the highest poetic form. But the theory of tragedy is worked out, says Abercrombie, with such insight, the comprehension, that it becomes the type of the theory of literature. The other subheading is tragedy distinguished from other poetic forms. Aristotle begins by pointing out that imitation is the common basis of all the fine arts, which, however, differ from each other in their medium of imitation, their objects of imitation, and their manner of imitation. Thus, poetry differs from painting and music in its medium of imitation. Poetry itself is divisible into epic and dramatic on the basis of its manner of imitation. The epic narrates, while the dramatic represents through action. The dramatic poetry itself is distinguished as tragic or comic on the basis of its objects of imitation. Tragedy imitates men as better and comedy as worse than they really are. In this way, does Aristotle establish the unique nature of tragedy and differentiates it from the other kinds of poetry. The other subheading is a superior form. Next, Aristotle proceeds to trace the origin and development of poetry. In the beginning, poetry was of two kinds. There were iambs, I-A-M-B-S, or invectives, I-N-V-E-C-T-I-B-E-S. On the one hand, and hymns on the gods, or panegyrics on the great, on the other. The first iambs or invectives developed into satiric, and the hymns and panegyrics into epic or heroic poetry. Out of heroic poetry developed tragedy, and out of satiric came the comedy. As tragedy is a later development, it is therefore a higher kind than the epic. In chapter 26 of the Poetics, the Greek philosopher compares tragedy with epic in a number of respects and demonstrates this superiority. Both epic and tragedy imitate serious subjects in a great kind of verse, but they differ in as much as epic imitates only in one kind of verse, both for its choral, choral, odes, and its dialogue. The epic is more lengthy and so more comprehensive and varied, but the tragedy has much greater concentration and so is more effective. Besides this, the tragedy has all the elements which the epic has, while there are certain elements of tragedy which the epic doesn't have. The epic lacks music and a spectacle, which are important constituents of tragedy and which enhances its effect. It has also reality of presentation and unity of action, both of which the epic lacks. The tragedy is superior because all the parts of an epic are included in tragedy, but those of tragedy are not all of them to be found in the epic. The next subheading is its definition. After this preliminary discussion, Aristotle comes to a consideration of the nature and function of tragedy. He defines tragedy as the imitation of an action, serious, complete, and of a certain magnitude in a language beautified in different parts with different kinds of embellishment through actions and not narration, and through senses of pity and fear bringing about the catharsis of these, that is, or such like emotions. This definition has wide implications. It falls naturally into two parts. The first part, from the imitation of an action to and not narration, is concerned with tragedy as one of the imitative arts and points out its medium, objects, and manner of imitation. The second part is concerned with the function and emotional effects of tragedy. The next subheading is its objects of imitation. Further, the definition first distinguishes tragedy from other forms of poetry. First, its objects of imitation are serious actions, and hence it is different from comedy, which imitates the non-serious. Humphrey House explains the words serious as meaning weighty, weighty, or important. Secondly, tragedy on the basis of its manner of imitation is distinguished from the epic, which narrates and doesn't represent through action. Thirdly, on the basis of its medium, it is distinguished from the lyric. It employs several kinds of embellishments in different parts, that is, words in dialogue and song in choric parts, C-H-O-R-I-C. The next subheading is its plot. Next, Aristotle examines the plot of tragedy. Tragedy imitates actions, and its plot consists of a logical and inevitable sequence of events. The action it imitates is its plot. The action must be complete, that is, it must have a beginning, a middle, and an end. The beginning is that from which further actions flows out, and which is intelligible in itself, and not consequent or dependent on any previous situation. A satisfying end is that which follows inevitably from what has gone before, but which doesn't lead to further action. It marks the completion of the tragic action. The middle is that which follows inevitably upon what has gone before and also leads on to an inevitable conclusion. At all points, Aristotle emphasizes that the tragic action must be in accordance with the laws of probability and necessity. The action for plot of a tragedy must be of a certain magnitude, and the word has been used in the sense of size or length. It must be long enough to permit an orderly development of action to a catastrophe. Too short an action cannot be regarded as proper and beautiful, for its different parts will be clearly visible, as in the case of a very small living creature. Neither should it be too long, for in that case it will not be taken in as an artistic whole by the memory. The action should be proportionate in the relation of the different parts of each other and to the whole. It must be an organic whole. Later on, Aristotle divides the plots of tragedy into two kinds, simple and complex. He calls a plot simple when the change in the fortunes of hero takes place without peripety and discovery, and the plot is complex when it involves one or the other or both. The peripety, P-E-R-I-P-E-T-Y, the peripety is the change in the fortunes of the hero, and the discovery is the change from ignorance to knowledge. Aristotle prefers a complex plot, for it startles, S-T-A-R-T-L-E-S, for it startles and captures attention, and so is likely to perform the tragic function more effectively than a simple plot. He regards the episodic plot, that is, a plot in which the different episodes introduced by the dramatist have neither probability nor necessity, as the worst of all. Indeed, throughout the Poetics, Aristotle lays great emphasis on the probability and necessity of the action of a tragedy. There must be a causal connection between the various events and incidents, and they must follow each other naturally and inevitably. No incident or character should be superfluous, S-U-P-E-R-F-L-U-O-U-S. The events introduced must be such as are probable under the circumstances. Similarly, Aristotle emphasizes unity of action. He is against plurality of action as it weakens the final effect of the tragedy. Then, the next subheading in this chapter is its embellishments, E-M-B-E-L-L-I-S-H-M-E-N-T-S. By the various embellishments in various parts, Aristotle means verse and song. Tragedy imitates through verse in the dialogue and through song in the choric parts. Verse and song beautify and decorate and give pleasure, but Aristotle doesn't regard them as essential or indispensable for the success of a tragedy. Then next subheading is its function. As regards the function of tragedy, Aristotle points out that it is to present scenes of fear and pity, and thus to bring about a catharsis of these emotions. But he doesn't supply any explanation of this function of tragedy. Hence, critics have advanced a number of explanations, and the term has been variously interpreted. What Aristotle exactly meant by the term can only be understood with a reference to his other works, more especially the Rhetoric, the Politics, and the Ethics. The whole question is a complex one, and a number of interpretations are possible. But for our purposes, it would suffice to say that by the catharsis of such emotions as pity and fear, he means their restoration to the right proportions, to the desirable mean, to the golden means, which is basis of his discussion of human qualities in the Ethics. The next subheading in this chapter is formative or constituent parts. Having examined the definition, nature, and function of tragedy, Aristotle comes to a consideration of its formative or constituent parts. He enumerates six formative elements of a tragedy: plot, character, diction, thought, spectacle, and song. Two of these parts relate to the medium of imitation, one to the manner of imitation, and three to the objects of imitation. Song or lyrical element is to be found in the choric parts of a tragedy. It is the embellishment spoken of earlier which distinguishes the tragedy from the epic. It is one of the sources of pleasure of tragedy. The spectacle or the scenic effects have more to do with stagecraft than with the writing of poetry, and hence Aristotle is of the view that the dramatist must depend on his effects, on his own powers, rather than on a spectacle. He writes, "Fear and pity can be produced by spectacular means, but it is much better to produce them by the way you write your play." This is one of those platitudes of Aristotle which human nature has always ignored, and the wisdom of which it has to learn again and again through experience. There can be no worse enemy of the art of the dramatist than the theater manager. The reliance on the theatrical and the sensational has spoiled many an excellent play. Is the power of saying whatever can be said, or what is appropriate to the occasion. Thought is required where a statement is made or some statement is proved or disproved. Thought is the intellectual element in a tragedy, and it is expressed through the speech of a character. This implies that only such speeches are significant as express the views and feelings of a character. This in itself brings out the importance of language of diction in tragedy. It is the language which gives us the thoughts and feelings of the various dramatic personae, and it is through speech that their character is first revealed. That is why the language of tragedy must be unusually expressive. Aristotle discusses the question at length in all its aspects and is the first writer to emphasize the expressive value or metaphorical language. He considers the gift of metaphor as the greatest of all. Metaphor is the source of the beauty and vividness of language. As a general rule, the language of tragedy must be clear and it must not be mean. The language must be clear but also dignified and elevated. In the interest of clarity, it must use familiar and current words, but rare and unfamiliar words must be introduced judiciously to impart elevation. The next subheading in this chapter is characterization. As regards characterization in general, Aristotle lays down four essential qualities. First, the characters must be good. Secondly, they must be appropriate. Thirdly, they must have likeness. And fourthly, they must have consistency. The characters should be good, but not too good or perfect. Wicked characters may be introduced, if required, by the plot. Aristotle is only against the wanton introduction of evil and wickedness. By appropriateness, Aristotle means that they must be true to type, that is, they must have the characteristics which are common to the profession, rank or class to which a particular character belongs. By likeness, Aristotle may mean either of two things. First, the characters must be lifelike. They must be true representatives of actual human nature. Or, secondly, they must be like the traditional or historical personages on whom they are modeled and whose name they bear. The characters must show a consistent development. If there is an inconsistent character, he must be represented as inconsistent throughout. There must be no sudden and unaccountable changes in character. In whatever the character says or does, the demands of necessity and probability must be satisfied. The next subheading in this chapter is Tragic Hero. Coming to a consideration of the ideal tragic hero, Aristotle lays down that he should neither be perfectly good nor utterly bad. He should be a man neither of blameless character nor a depraved, D-E-P-R-A-V-E-D, depraved villain. He is a man of ordinary weaknesses and virtues like ourselves, leaning more to the side of good than of evil, occupying a position of eminence and falling into ruin, R-U-I-N, and falling into ruin from that eminence not because of any deliberate wickedness but because of some error of judgment on his part. In short, he should be a man such as is likely to help the tragedy in performing its proper function, that is, that of bringing about a catharsis of the emotion of pity and fear. Obviously, we feel pity and fear at the spectacle of a man like us suffering not because of some deliberate villainy but because of some error of judgment. The next subheading in this chapter is the plot, its vital significance. While all the six elements listed above are essential to tragedy and have always been employed by poets, the most important constituent of tragedy, according to Aristotle, is plot. It is the very soul of tragedy. By plot, Aristotle means the arrangement of incidents. Incidents mean action, and tragedy is an imitation of actions, both external and internal. That is, it also imitates the mental processes of the dramatis personae. He likens the plot of a tragedy to a living organism and says it must be a complete whole, like a living organism, and like it also of a certain magnitude or length. It must have the unity of a living organism. Just as in a living organism every part is essential to the life of the whole, so also in a tragedy there should be nothing superfluous. Every incident must take the action a step further, and it should not be possible to remove any single incident without causing injury to the entire action. In a successful plot, the various incidents are casually related to each other and are also probable and necessary under the circumstances. Play of chance may be allowed, but only to a limited extent, and only in case of incidents which are not actually represented on the stage. Further, Aristotle clearly states that this unity of plot cannot arise merely by the presence of a single hero. A wide variety of incidents might befall a single individual in life, and all of them cannot go into the making of the plot. The artist must properly select and order his material and thus impart artistic unity to it. Plurality of action characterizes the epic, but in tragedy it weakens the tragic effect and so must be avoided. The plot should be so framed that it arouses the emotions of pity and fear among the spectators, which is the function of tragedy. A tragic plot, therefore, must avoid, first, showing of a perfectly good man passing from the happiness to misery, showing a bad man rising from misery to happiness, and showing an extremely bad man falling from happiness to misery. The best tragic plot is one which shows a good man, but not perfectly good one, suffering as a consequence of some error or fault, hamartia, on his own part, hamartia. The next subheading in this chapter is Plot and Character, a comparative study. As regards the comparative importance of plot and character, Aristotle is quite emphatic that plot is more important than character. He goes to the extent of saying that there can be a tragedy without character, but none without plot. In order to explain that plot is the fundamental thing, the Greek philosopher compares plot to the outline sketch of a painter. Just as colors, however beautiful, have no meaning and significance without the outline, so also the tragedy has no shawl, no significance without plot. It is plot which, like the painter's outline, gives meaning and significance to character. The other subheading is The Unities, UNITIES. Aristotle emphasizes only one of the three unities, the unity of action. He is against plurality of action as it weakens the tragic effect. There might be a number of incidents, but they must be casually connected with each other, and they must all be conducive to one effect, the effect aimed at by the dramatist. As regards the unity of time, Aristotle only once mentions it in relation to dramatic action. Comparing the epic and the tragedy, he writes, "Tragedy tries, as far as possible, to live within a single revolution of the sun, or only slightly to exceed it, whereas the epic observes no limits in its time of action. It is merely a suggestion, tries as far as possible. There is nothing here that can be called a rule," and indeed, several of the Greek tragedies with which Aristotle must have been familiar far exceed his time limit. He never mentions the unity of place at all, or even says that it is desirable to confine the action to a single place. The doctrine of the three unities, which has figured so much in the literary criticism since the Renaissance, cannot be laid to his account. He is not the author of it. It was foisted on him by Renaissance critics of Italy and France. The other subheading in this chapter is Sources of Tragic Pleasure. The end of poetry is to give pleasure, and tragedy has its own distinctive pleasure as well as the pleasure which is common to all poetry. According to Aristotle, the function of poetry is to give a certain refined pleasure, and in this he goes counter to the view that the poet is primarily an ethical teacher. Each kind of poetry has its own aesthetic pleasure. However, this proper aesthetic pleasure can be possible only when the requirements of morality are satisfied. Thus, he considers pleasure as essential and moral function as only incidental. Aristotle recognized the value of emotional effects of poetry. Plato had condemned poetry because of its disturbing emotional effects. Aristotle points out that it brings us a sense of relief through catharsis. The sources of tragic pleasure pointed out by him may be listed as follows. First, the pleasure is derived partly from our natural sense of harmony and rhythm. Words and rhyme are not necessary, but they certainly enhance the pleasure of poetry. Second, it is also derived partly from the instinct of imitation. It is pleasure arising from seeing a thing or action well imitated. A successful tragedy gives pleasure because it satisfies our basic instinct of imitation. Third, poetry is imitation, and imitation of something with which we are not familiar increases our knowledge, and to know, to learn is pleasure. Fourth, but these two sources of pleasure are common to all poetry. What about the distinctive pleasure of tragedy? The peculiar pleasure of tragedy is caused by the catharsis of the emotions of pity and fear. Fifth, tragedy imitates action and life, its pain and misery, and if this imitation is well done, it is gripping and absorbing. There is a total emotional identification of the spectator with the person who suffers on the stage. Peripeteia, peripeteia, and anagnorisis, anagnorisis, are commended by Aristotle because they heighten the seductive power, the gripping interest of the action. Pure pleasure results from the exercise of our emotions, senses, and thoughts on the tragic action. In this way, we smile through our tears. Sixth, tragedy gives pleasure because it results in enhanced understanding of life and its problems. It provides a kind of inner illumination. Seventh, the unity of the plot, the diction, and the spectacle, etc., are other sources of pleasure in a tragedy. The next subheading in this chapter is conclusion. Such are the main features of Aristotle's theory of tragedy. The theory might have its weaknesses. Aristotle knows only Greek tragedy. His conclusions are based entirely on the drama with which he was familiar, and hence often his views are not of universal application. But despite all that can be said against it, Aristotle's theory of tragedy is the foundation on which all subsequent discussions of literary aesthetics has most securely based itself. Aristotle's views might have been challenged, but their history is the history of tragedy. And the remaining part of this chapter, we will continue in the next file. And the name of the next topic is the theory of imitation, its nature, comparison with Plato.